Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Today on Truth and Movies, German director Christian Petzold finishes his Love in Times of Oppressive Systems trilogy with the drama Transit. It's Tarantino Unchained. Leo and Brad star in the glorious, pulpy, and certainly fictional Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
You could do anything you want to him. Throw him off a building, right? Light him on fire.
And in Film Club, we're assessing the state of Tate with the Wrecking Crew.
Wise man, enjoy pleasure before business.
All coming up in Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Hello there, movie truthers. It's Michael Leader here in the host's seat this week, sitting across from head honcho of Little White Lies himself, David Jenkins.
Hey.
And Hannah Woodhead as well from Little White Lies.
Hey.
Welcome,
I thought
both.
You were going to call me like mini honcho. Han honcho.
Han honcho.
The Han honcho.
Michael, I've got to ask about this new thing of movie truthers.
Can we not call the all the listeners out there in Podland movie truthers because they listen to Truth and Movies?
But the intimation is something a little bit more sinister, maybe.
Does it have to be sinister?
It's almost like people who deny the existence of Truth and Movies. Through some weird conspiracy theory.
We have never taken a photograph in these walls, so
that's
it might
true.
Not exist.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you could let us know.
Like the moon landing.
So our fans are called truthers.
Or movie truthers.
Movie truthers. Oh, okay.
The listeners to Truth and Movies. Listeners, let us know what you think about this appellation, if you want to be called this or something else at the usual channels. At Truth and Movies on Twitter, probably the best place right now. And maybe at Davey Jenkins into that tweet as well.
I'd love to know. I genuinely would.
But speaking of listener correspondence, we did have one from last week's episode from Ryan saying, after listening to the latest pod and Sophie telling everyone to treat yourself to his Girl Friday, I thought I would shamelessly mention that the Criterion Blu-ray is £10 at FOP at the moment.
That's a bargain. Oof.
Bargain, right? For a classic
cinema. Get down there.
Exactly. But anyway, any other business before we dive into this week's episode? Any news on the Twilight Horizon? We're hoping the weather improves, aren't we, Hannah? Because this weekend we're going to Green Man Festival.
Yeah, our friend of the podcast, Jake Cunningham, has been sending me weather updates every day, and the Brecon Beacons are looking rainy. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be wet for us. We've got our wellies packed. But yeah, Adam Woodward has programmed the cinema. Program, I guess, cinema.
I hope tent. It's a tent.
Is it a tent?
Cinema Drome.
The cinema. Wow, like Thunderdome.
Yes.
At Green Man, he does it sort of every year, and mm-hmm. this year he's really pulled it out of the bag. We've got Beats, a preview of The Souvenir, I believe. Wow. I'm pretty sure Missing Link as well for mm-hmm. the little ones when you're hungover and you're like, okay, get the child in a tent so we don't have to talk to it for 2 hours. And of course, you will be there with Jake Cunningham.
I will be, yes. Wearing my other podcast hat for Ghibliotech, we're going to be presenting a 30th anniversary screening of Hayao Miyazaki's Kiki's Delivery Service. And then afterwards, we're going to have a chat on stage with you, Hannah.
Yeah.
We're going to be taking to the stage at the Cinemadrome, Thunderdome style.
I'm very excited. I love that movie.
That's going to be really rad because having been to the festival many times, it's very, very, very super kid friendly. Mm-hmm. But definitely not in a negative way. Like, and any like animations is like, we could go and see this like sludgy rock band playing some dirge over in this tent here, or with the kids like nipping at our Mac saying we want to go and get some food or we want to go do something else. So like, yeah, those films will like pack out.
Mm-hmm. And if it's raining as well, I guess.
Oh, brilliant.
Okay. Good. Capture audience. That's
absolutely
what we want.
No pressure whatsoever. But if you are down there at Green Man, listeners, come down and say hi. Shelter from the storm, perhaps. But we should talk about this week's films. We're going to talk a lot about Tarantino and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood later on, but let's start first with Christian Petzold's Transit. When fleeing Paris after a German invasion, Georg escapes to Marseille, assuming the identity of a dead author whose papers he possesses. Everything changes, though, when Georg falls in love with the mysterious Marie, who is desperate to find her missing husband. We don't have a clip for this one. It's in German and French. But David, give us a taste of who Christian Petzold is. Maybe listeners might have seen his previous film, Phoenix, that came out a couple of years ago. But what's his vibe?
Yeah, so he's had a couple of films come out in the UK in the past. I got on board with him with this film he did called Yella, Y-E-L-L-A. It's his take on like Carnival of Souls, like a modern art house take on Carnival of Souls, where right. you're following this woman and you kind of don't know if she's dead or alive, essentially. And yeah, he's always someone who toys with genre. I've interviewed him before, and he is like one of these guys who is intimidatingly intelligent, but very, very generous as well. You can imagine him being like a professor of something. You know, he's so knowledgeable about film, literature, history, politics, philosophy. I mean, he's got all the key bases very, very well covered. And one of the great things about his movies is he's not someone who is like, I'm going to take this vast wealth of knowledge that I have and just sort of throw it up there on the screen, and if you're not on the level, then that's your problem. His films are very sort of welcoming, and I think he kind of mixes big ideas with quite sort of superficial entertainment elements as well. He had this film called Barbara set in the during the kind of post-war period, which ended up being a kind of really big hit for him. He has a muse, an actress called Nina Hoss, who's in many of his films, although not in this this new one. Phoenix from 2014 was, I thought, one of the best films of that year. And I was super excited to see this one. But it's a weird thing where, like, I don't know, like, it feels like it's happening more often where we have these weeks where you have this one giant behemoth coming out that everyone's eyes are on, that everyone's kind of slathering over. The anticipation is super high. But then you know, you have to, it's our job to do the due diligence and make sure people see, you know, maybe once they've seen the big one, you know, if they've got a bit of extra change in their pocket, that what's the next option? And you know, this would definitely be it, I think. Right. So Petzold's part of what I think has been termed as the Berlin School, which is a group of German filmmakers who are looking at ideas of identity in kind of post-war Germany. And the effect that the war has had on the German character, and all these ideas play up in these films. And yeah, Transit is one of those films. It's kind of, you might call it a metafiction. It's like a story that is ostensibly taking place during the sort of mid to late period of the Second World War, during the sort of Nazi occupation of France, and the sort of how that is expanding across the country. But actually, it's filmed in contemporary era Marseille, and you know, you have all these anachronisms. You have cars, and he's eating wine and pizza in a little kind of trattoria restaurant, and it's not too over the top. It's not like they've got mobile phones and tweeting. He's not sort of pushing that idea of like, it's modern times, man. But the film is essentially a kind of, everyone's trying to get the last boat out of Marseille to America into freedom, and it's this sort of bureaucratic nightmare of securing papers and transit forms and trying to make it as official as you can, even if you're riding under someone else's name. And it's this idea of, it really wasn't that simple to escape, you know, just get out. And people are kind of always asking, is there a better option than walking over the Pyrenees into Spain? You know, like, yeah, I thought this was really great film. Really, really great.
Oh, terrific. Hannah, so did you see this back at, was it Berlin? Was it the way it premiered?
Yeah, Berlin last year. So it's been a while. And actually, David told me to go and watch this. I hadn't seen any Petzold at the time. And I was underwhelmed, shall we say, on that cold day in Berlin in a theatre about 9 o'clock in the morning. I just kind of wasn't in the right headspace, maybe. Right. And even though it's only about 1 hour 40, I was like, this feels so long and I don't understand what's happening. And
can I just say, I had an almost identical experience with Barbara.
Ah,
okay.
Like, I saw Barbara in Berlin and was a bit like, this is so dull. But revisited it later and had it
exactly,
different.
Yeah, okay. In preparation for this podcast, and having seen literally everyone say how great this film was, and me sort of thinking, oh, maybe I'm an idiot and I should have loved this film. And lo and behold, I rewatched it at the weekend, and it's really good. When I was in Cannes earlier this year, I saw the new Terrence Malick, which sounds like I'm just flexing now, but there is a point to this. And Franz Rogowski plays like a supporting role in that. And I was like, oh yeah, the guy from Transit. Yeah, I remember him. And then watching this again, I was like, oh, he's just really good in everything he does. He's got these kind of huge like bug eyes that kind of like endear you to him. And I think the character of Georg is so kind of hapless and trodden down by life. And he kind of walks with, like, you know, his shoulders up by his neck. And just seeing him kind of stood next to Paula Beer, who's this, you know, tall, very beautiful woman who is kind of in dire straits. There's something about that contrast between the two. It's been compared a lot to Casablanca, but, you know, he's no Humphrey Bogart. Pause there. Cut out the pause.
He's absolutely no Ingrid Bergman, really, is he?
she absolutely is Ingrid Bergman, but actually watching it again, I was surprised at how simple a story it is. It's a story about a man trying to get to a destination and hearing these stories from all the people around him. There's this woman who has been left behind by her friend, and she's looking after these two like beautiful dogs. And there's this beautiful quote in the film, I think, from the narrator who says, I'm paraphrasing here, but he says something like, he realised he was in a port, and ports are a place for stories, and who was he to deny them their stories? And yeah, it is really like, the second time around, it just zipped by. I was having not a great time because it's a story essentially about ethnic cleansing, but I don't want to be one of those people that says this feels like a really important film for now, but it kind of does. It's, you know, it's based on a story by Anna Seghers, which was written in 1944 in the aftermath of World War II. But it is still exactly the kind of thing that is happening today. And you can imagine this exact scenario in countries across the world. You can imagine these exact conversations going on. And I really, yeah, I think it's just a really beautiful film that everyone should go and watch, regardless of what they're going to do with the Quentin Tarantino, go and watch Transit.
Well, I think that's the whole thing about the setting. And it's kind of gently pushing that idea of, like, universality and linking it to the sort of migrant crisis, quote-unquote, that's happening now. So, and this idea of trying to escape from Europe or escape, you know, being nudged around countries, and that sort of danger you find yourself in every day, and this idea of the police siren just stopping you in your tracks, whatever you're doing.
I think that sense you get for the danger, but also the monotony, is really interesting. You know, I think so many films about, not about the Holocaust specifically, but about people trying to flee an area, very like, you know, are they going to make it? They going to make it? And then kind of use the drama and the tension to, you know, put you on the edge of your seat. But in this, you just really get a sense for kind of how demoralising it is, and how these people were treated like cattle, and you know, how that kind of plays on someone's psyche and makes them kind of feel like stuck in this Kafka-esque nightmare where they go to a building every day and they stand in a queue and then nothing happens, and they go back and do the same thing every single day.
And instead, the conflict and tension comes from Georg is given a get-out-of-France-free card by being allowed to assume the identity of this dead author. But instead, he's racked with, I guess, guilt and indecision as to whether he should go, he should leave. He strikes up these friendships and relationships with people in Marseille who don't have it as lucky as he does. And instead, it's this meditation on being the one that gets out versus the one that can't get out.
When you put it like that, it makes it sound like quite a kind of Hollywoodian film. Like, you get the guy who is like out for himself and for self-preservation, who, through his kind of imposed stay in this port town, waiting for his ship to sail, he learns the value of humanity and empathy, and becomes the man who basically gives everything up for his friends. And is that too spoilery? No. Well, you know, he learns that other people have similar needs to him, and he can see that maybe other people have. There's a lot of learning going on, I guess, and that makes it sound extremely cheesy, and it's not. And I think the film is really focused on, kind of chronicles the process of a change of heart, of someone actually learning and developing and building on their own personal philosophy of life, and, you know, this idea of seeing people's personal tragedies in this bigger context and wondering the price of personal sacrifice as well. And again, everything is so downplayed. Yeah. It's not a melodrama, although it does have these kind of really kind of emotional moments in the film. I don't mean to talk of melodrama in a pejorative. I love melodrama, but like, it's super subtle, I think.
And at every turn, it moves away from what you'd expect from the genre it may be playing within. As you say, melodrama, war movie, or noir, basically being a person who's moving through these strictures larger than themselves. It's the anti-Casablanca, really, because in this world that Petzold paints in this adaptation, that you can't make grand heroic statements. You can't have these cool reveals and single lines of dialogue and so on.
I think it probably is a spoil, but there's a great bit later on where he does something quite selfless for someone else and has to disguise the action.
Yeah.
And he kind of makes his peace with knowing that the person he's helping is going to think he's a horrible person. Mm-hmm. And there's no kind of, you know, there's no... Georg is kind of destined to go down in history as no one. Mm-hmm. Not go down in history, I guess. He's just another guy who will get stuck in Marseille and no one will remember him. And it's, you know, I think it's quite refreshing in that respect. It's just about the many, many thousands of people who just live their lives waiting to get to a better place and kind of never get there, really. Mm-hmm. Is that a spoiler?
I don't think it's a spoiler.
This is a hard film to spoil, really, because, mm-hmm. you know, it's more about the atmosphere, man. It's, you know...
But I think that's one of the things I really love about it. I think you kind of touched on it there, is this idea of, on one side, it's kind of toying with the classics and noir and Hollywood romance, wartime romance. But on the other... it's really about these very kind of small logistics and bureaucratic questions, things that go wrong, ways that you can't rely on people to just do a very simple thing that you would never really see in a Hollywood film. Mm-hmm. And it kind of melds those two things together. It's one of those films where I'm just like totally locked in there and I just feel like every single line, every shot has just been very, very well thought through and perfectly sculpted to fit the film, and it is adding to a kind of bigger picture.
So I'm expecting ones or twos here score wise from you, David. What scores would you give for In Anticipation, Enjoyment in retrospect?
I'd probably say Anticipation was probably like very high, five. Mm-hmm. I've liked his films in the past and I think he's someone who's well overdue a big kind of retrospective. I mean, I've been very effusive, I know, but I maybe didn't quite like this to the levels I liked Phoenix, because I think Phoenix has this utterly jaw-dropping, like, final scene. It's a kind of mic drop finale. Okay. Whereas I feel that the sort of final few shots here where everything is tight, it's such a delicate film that, and every shot does count so much, that there's a few final scenes that just don't, they just leave it a little loose for me. Mm. And it's probably like 4.449999. It's so close to a five, but it's not quite for me.
Okay.
And then a four. Yeah, 5.44.
Hannah, I'm expecting your retrospect to go up, I guess, basically.
I wasn't sure if I should do it from my rewatch or from my
your
first
entire
watching.
Relationship with the film, maybe.
Okay.
I don't know.
So I guess it was like a three in anticipation. I normally trust David's judgment when he tells me I should watch something. Mm-hmm. Normally.
Wow.
And then I'm going to say it was a three for enjoyment the first time. This is getting complex now. I feel like I'm having to give two. But then in retrospect, yeah, definitely a four. I think I got so much more out of it the second time around. And it really does kind of prove that if you're flip-flopping on a film, like, ooh, didn't think it was that good, I think it does benefit you massively to go back and watch again sometimes. Mm.
There is a case for, like, festivals being great places to launch movies. And I think that Transit is an example of a film. And I think all of his films, they're so delicate and subtle that I think... that kind of glitzy context where you have people rushing out forming an opinion, like as they're sort of getting up from their chair, it's just not the right way to see it, really.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because you could also apply similar logic to the film we're about to talk
indeed
about next.
Yeah.
But first I'll say 3.34 for me on Transit. I think this is a film that, especially that decision to not set it in the present but just use present day setting for this wartime tale, makes it a real thinker. It really is growing in my mind.
I mean, I think it's quite a nice segue to this, the film we're about to follow, because, I mean, you know, two films that are kind of dealing with history in a very personal way and sort of subverting what we know as the historical reality into something more personal.
And our next film this week is the Playmobil movie.
Yes.
No, we've got our transit papers from Marseille. We're going across the Atlantic to America for Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. 1969, Los Angeles. Leonardo DiCaprio is down on his luck TV actor Rick Dalton, while Brad Pitt is Cliff Booth, his longtime stunt double come driver. Together, they make their way through an industry that's changing rapidly as the end of the decade looms and the cult of Charles Manson brews on the fringes of Hollywood society. Here's a clip featuring Rick trying to get Cliff a gig on a show.
I'm asking you to help me out, man. If the answer's no. Not no with excuses.
Hey, man. This ain't a Andy McLaughlin picture, you know? And I can't afford to hire a bunch of guys that smoke cigarettes and sit around talking to each other all day on the chance that I might use them. I got a four-man team here, Rick. If I need more than that, I got to get it approved. And, you know, I got to look after my dudes.
Hey, and if your dudes were a better match for me, I'd say, oh, okay, you got me. But that's not the case, and you know it. He's a great match for
me.
Hey, you could do anything you want to him. Throw him off a building, right? Light him on fire. Hit him with a Lincoln, right? Get creative. Do whatever you want. He's just happy for the opportunity.
Rick?
Yeah.
I don't dig him. And I don't dig the vibe he brings on a set.
Well, Hannah, I think you dug this one, didn't you? Your review called it wry, self-aware, uncharacteristically sweet.
Yeah. Quote me on that. No, I'm a big Tarantino. I was going to say Tarantino head. That's not what they call themselves. I'm a big Tarantino fan. I have been since I was a kid, just sort of first getting into films. I remember watching Pulp Fiction for the first time on a DVD that I begged my mum to rent from the library, and I was like, what? This is crazy. Why isn't everyone always talking about this movie? This is insane. And then my brother paid. He was 18 at the time, and he bought my tickets for Inglourious Bastards so I could go and watch that when I was 16. And again, had a very similar experience in that I was just spellbound. And I think his films are a kind of, because they're so ubiquitous and readily available, they are a gateway drug. If you're a teenager from a small town who wants to get into film but doesn't really know where to start, you kind of start with the Tarantinos and the Scorseses of the world, and you watch their films and you see things and you think, oh, I wonder what that is. You Google it, you find another 20 filmmakers you want to watch. So for me, you know, I can't really underestimate or undersell, rather, how excited I was to see this in Cannes, despite the fact that our seats were not great after 2 hours of queuing, kind of being sat at a right angle to the screen, but didn't impact enjoyment at all. I had an absolutely amazing time with this film. Mm-hmm. I think it is truly one of his best works to date. I think it is, as I said in my review, I think it's doing some things that he hasn't done before. And overall, it's just a really like beautiful, lovely bromance film, really, more than anything. And that's not what I expected when it was like, yeah, Charles Manson, yeah, yes, Sharon Tate, that's what we're going for. I was like, oh, okay, this is going to be terrible and incredibly poor taste. But I think he's really pulled it out the bag.
Well, that's what this film is. It's the majority of the film. It's a long film. It's structured like a hangout movie, not too dissimilar maybe to Jackie Brown, maybe. It's where really the plot doesn't come into it until the back half of the film. And instead you're just hanging out with Leo and Brad.
You are, yeah. And who doesn't want to do that? I think Rick Dalton and Cliff Booth are two of the most lovely Tarantino characters ever. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no kind of Vince and Jules bravado here. It's just two guys who really care about each other and really don't kind of know what they do without each other. Mm-hmm. I was going to say a spoiler then. I'm not going to say it.
Okay.
I think the sort of chemistry that those two have is so easy and winning, and they're so inherently charming. You almost kind of go because you want to just watch them for, mm-hmm. for 2.5 hours, and it totally delivers on that front. And I think this is easily the best that DiCaprio's been, you know, in absolutely years. I think there's been a lot of, like, talk around maybe he should have won an Oscar for this instead of The Revenant.
He may still win an Oscar for this.
But I think definitely, yeah, this is kind of him at the height of his powers. He just doesn't seem to care, like, you know, feel it as deeply. It's not like, yes, I'm a serious actor. He's just loose and having fun with it. And same with Brad. I think Brad is the star of the show here. Cliff Booth is like, he's just so cool.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I try and analyse the character in a scholarly way, I'm like, yeah, but he's just really cool. He's just, you know, he hangs around in his Hawaiian shirts, cruising around like down there. Rodeo Drive, and he's got this really cute dog called Brandy, who he's got trained, and he's just, there's something about him. He really, it's one of those roles where you just think, I can't imagine anyone else doing this. And I think there's been a lot of people who've been quite surprised by the lack of Tarantinoisms in this film, the lack of kind of ultra violence. There is a bit, but not what I think we've come to expect. But it really does feel like a kind of grown up Tarantino film. It feels like he's been doing this how many years? 30 years? And this is kind of the sum of all those things he's learned and all the controversy he's courted and all the stupid, inane things he's said over the years. I think this really does feel to me like he's trying to iron some things out, work some things out, and it really does. It all sort of works for me on that level.
I mean, already there are three or four or five hot button topics in this film people are pulling apart for all their hot takes. We don't come
the
to it for hot takes.
There's been quite a lot about this film. It was a lot before the film even premiered, and it's kind of not started. And I don't think Tarantino does himself any favours. He can be very defensive, and I think critics are well within their rights to have issues with this film, to have issues with how Tarantino uses violence against women, how he uses female characters in general, and particularly the portrayal of Bruce Lee in this film has kind of garnered a lot of negative press. Bruce Lee's daughter spoke out and said that she was very upset with how he's portrayed in the film. But I'm kind of glad that, you know, in this economy, we have films like this that kind of feel like they're trying to say something and do something and can sort of generate this level of discourse around them.
And a filmmaker who is really thinking about what's on the page, on the screen, in between the lines, and around the auditorium as well. The fact that this is a film in some ways about the, you know, Hollywood being saved by the power of cinema. without saying any spoilers, he's using his directorial pen, as he has in Django Unchained and Inglourious Basterds, to rewrite history here in a fantastical spin. But by doing that, he brings together two of the biggest stars of current Hollywood to show that we can make movies that have style and point and intelligence to them, as well as being fun and provocative.
Yeah, I mean, nowadays it seems like every time we come on this show, every few weeks we're having to talk about the new Disney live action movie or the new superhero movie. And listeners to this show will know that I quite like superhero movies, but
I love superhero movies.
Getting called out on my own.
It's fine.
I did give Endgame 5 stars. So
Endgame was good. I don't care what anyone says, but I feel it. I feel that kind of hunger for these films that make you kind of remember why you love going to the cinema and why you love talking about movies. And this is one of those films. I think it really does demonstrate what you can do if you give a director a budget and some stars and a bit of time, you know? And I don't think there are many directors who can command that anymore. Yeah. I don't think there are many Tarantinos out there who, not for lack of talent, but just for lack of studios not wanting to take a risk or to give them the money or, you know, now I'm going off on a tangent, but we only have to look at kind of the number of projects that have been cancelled since the Disney and Fox merger to kind of understand that it is worrying. You know, is there going to be a lot more of these kind of big budget, big name films, and which are wholly original? I don't know.
I almost feel that this is it, what's happening here. Is it's almost similar to like publishing, where I almost see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as like an amazing long read, and you kind of got to wonder: would I prefer one amazing long read a month or like 20 little short hot takes? Would I sacrifice those for one big one? And I've kind of thought maybe I would, you know, like not that I'd want to see fewer films being made. I feel that like Tarantino has like paid his dues. I mean, he's kind of come up through the system, and Reservoir Dogs first film was a hit, and you know, it's been upwards from there. So I feel that he's kind of earned the right to make this movie. Sorry, you were going to...
Well, no, I was saying that you mentioned Marvel in passing there. Even this film has a sort of subtle Stan Lee cameo, because there are a couple of Stan Lee-written comics that appear in certain shots.
I love it.
I think, in fact, Brad Pitt, when he goes back to his trailer and he's feeding his dog and kicks back, he's reading, I think it's like one of the cowboy comics that was being published in that sort of early Marvel age, which I found very interesting. I wonder if that's Tarantino. Of course, he's mentioned comics before in Kill Bill and True Romance as well. I wonder if that's him tipping the hat to Stan Lee as probably the subtlest of the Stan Lee tributes we've had this year.
I mean, I guess the guy is going to make a Star Trek movie, so Tarantino doesn't really care about franchise fever. But the amount of talent, I think, assembled in this cast can't really be undersold. I think, obviously, you know, Leo and Brad aside, it was really nice to see Margot Robbie kind of getting this. I think there was so much said about this role and before anyone had even seen the film. And then, of course, in Cannes, there was the whole press conference disaster where I think it was Time journalist said, you know, why doesn't she have much screen time? And Tarantino got quite huffy. But I think the way she's utilised in this film is just perfect. I think she is very much the heart of the film, this kind of girl. That's offensive. This woman who is really at the start of her career. She's not thinking like Cliff and Rick are about, you know, them coming towards the end of their career and kind of panicking wildly. She's really full of this wonder and this hope and this energy and light that I think it couldn't be more obvious that Tarantino obviously holds Sharon Tate in very high esteem and, you know, kind of, I think, mourns the idea of this woman more than anything. But at the same time, I think he does go to a lot of effort to make it not feel like she's just this manic pixie dream girl. She does, Robbie especially, brings this real warmth to her and this real personality. There's a great scene where she goes to watch her own film in a cinema, the film which we'll be talking about in a minute, The Wrecking Crew, which is a terrible film, but anyway. I think you can tell from watching it, because in the film you're watching her watch the actual footage. So you've got Margot Robbie sat there.
In a fairly empty cinema.
In a fairly empty cinema. It's the first time I've really watched Margot Robbie in a film and felt like, oh wow, yeah, I kind of get what everyone's talking about now. Even like I, Tonya, I didn't get the feeling I got watching this, that she is really well-placed to play Sharon Tate. And, you know, you just feel this kind of like pull towards her. You want to, and I'm glad he, Tarantino, went back and put some more of her in, because you watch her just walking around, going to a rare bookshop to pick up a copy of Tess of the D'Urbervilles, just living her life and living this life that she never got to live in real life. And I think it's, I keep saying sweet, but it is. It's just really lovely.
I think that Wrecking Crew scene will go in and down as one of the great Tarantino scenes.
Oh, definitely.
I know that Guillermo del Toro is the man that believes in cinema, but so does Tarantino. We should plug the video interview that Adam Woodward did with Tarantino and Margot Robbie, and he asks them that question, did you ever go and see your first appearance in a major movie at the cinema? And Tarantino says that when Reservoir Dogs was playing around LA, he saw every single screening for the first week or whatever.
He didn't know who was going to ever make another movie.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, I don't pretend to know the mind of Tarantino at all. Many books could be written about the mind of Tarantino. But like you say, I think he really does believe in cinema. And if you love cinema, you know, this is a movie about that kind of the agony and the ecstasy of watching movies, making movies, you know, the whole kind of start to finish process. And the whole Manson thing, which we've barely even talked about, is such a kind of small part of that. But I will shout out another great scene in the film on the Spahn Ranch where the Mansons kind of hung out, I guess, which again is like just a kind of masterclass in tension and proves that Tarantino, for as much as he's good at staging a shootout in a tiny bar underground, you know, he can also kind of absolutely just ramp up the tension with nothing more than kind of silence and Lena Dunham and Dakota Fanning's like kind of giving Brad Pitt evils.
Yeah.
I think, you know, for this to be his 9th film and it still feel like he's trying new things and pushing himself as a filmmaker is really kind of remarkable to me.
Yeah. David, you saw this outside of the Cannes bubble. How did all this play for you? Were you on board with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Yeah, I was on board. I've got some issues with it, but I think it's one of those films where I don't think it's that easy to just come out and have a very kind of binary take on it, like, yes, it works, no, it doesn't, because I think there's so much tinkering with context and the way that information and history is presented. It's kind of put through this mill of all these various influences. I've thought about the film a lot, and, you know, it's essentially like this apocryphal tale of these two characters who didn't really exist but were sort of
composites
of various influences, and we're watching them move through the industry at this kind of key time, but actually looking at how they affected the reality of history and of what we know it, and how their presence fed into the Manson murders, which were going on, and which they kind of, in a sort of roundabout way, become implicated in. The more I think about it, this isn't history, I don't think. This is pure fantasy. Mm-hmm. Going back to Marvel, a term that you hear uttered over and over again is world building. Mm-hmm. But in Marvel world, I think for me, I find it done in a very kind of schematic way that is just pushing, world building is purely for like franchise purposes and getting you to the next film, to the next film, to the next film. Whereas this is its very self-enclosed thing where every element is Tarantino fantasy. The way cinemas look, what they're playing, what people eat, what people listen to, the adverts on the radio, the way people dress, even the attitudes as well. I mean, like, one thing you really get from this, again, a bone of contention among many people is this idea that he absolutely hates hippies. Like, the broader context is that the Manson murders signaled the end of the Summer of Love, 1969. It's the 60s were over, man. Mm-hmm. They're selling hippie wigs down Woolworths. It's that kind of it is that kind of moment where the dream dies. This kind of, sun bleached sense of like euphoria, of free love, of happiness. Getting rid of the starched 50s. It's gone. And a new era is going to be rolling in soon. There's a feeling that this is a film as much about that reality as the fact that Tarantino resents that reality and trying to imagine what if the 60s lasted forever. I'm not going to show you what that would look like, but I'm going to offer you my case of like why the 60s were great. Look how cool the film posters were. Look at the soundtracks. Look at the music that was playing. Look at the cars people drove. I think what makes this film great is that it's got this kind of two-pole thing where you have the story itself and the characters, which are some of his best, I think, and most compelling. But you also have this granular production design where, like, every shot is packed full of stuff. There was a tweet written about this where it was like, oh, this film is a film that you could write a book on straight away. And I sort of thought, oh, that's just someone being, like, over the top. But then genuinely, like, that tweet has kind of stuck with me quite a bit. And I think that, like, if you were to go through and meticulously unpick everything here, there is just books worth of stuff. Reminded me a bit of American Graffiti, which was our first ever film club, especially the sound design of, like, you've got snatches of songs and people listening to the radio, and it doesn't just get this idea of what people were listening to and what people were watching. It was like how they were watching it.
And the rhythms of the narrative are driving around.
Exactly.
Driving around town.
You get this sense of where things were placed and what Hollywood Boulevard felt like. But it's all pure fantasy. Mm. I feel that like Tarantino has done his homework by watching an absolute incredible amount of crap, probably. But actually, he's like, the way he's written this film is like he's filtered that through rather than just throwing it all up on the screen. I mean, the references are, I don't necessarily, I think, meant to be taken in a sort of narcissistic, like, performative show of like, look how much I've done to actually build this film. Look at how much energy I've put into every element of this film's production design. It is actually like, this is my fantasy. Join me.
Also, as well, I think we talk about it being his fantasy. I think it could feel like, Tarantino being like, these damn kids moving on with their Xboxes and Game Boys, like another...
Like Jim Jarmusch.
But to me, as a youth, it felt very kind of bittersweet. I think that Tarantino's done a lot of soul-searching and kind of recognises his own limitations as a very privileged white man in Hollywood who made some very violent films in his younger years, which have constantly, I think, been in a state of reappraisal and reevaluation ever since they were made. And this is kind of a through line in the whole film. There's like reckoning with your own growing obsoleteness. This is the whole thing that Rick's kind of dealing with the whole way through, is what if this is it for me, whereas Cliff is the other side of the coin, and that he's like, well, we had a good ride, he's very like kind of
content
content. Yeah, he just doesn't mind. Like, and that's what makes him so cool. You know, he's just like, oh, I'll just stay at home and eat mac and cheese with my dog. You know, he's very, but also, oh, it could have felt to me a bit like Old Man Yells at Cloud. You know, it could have felt like Tarantino raging against this, like, this new system and this new world that's coming, which doesn't really necessarily need men like him, filmmakers like him. But it doesn't. I mean, I think one of the things that really amuses me about the film is that he's brought in all these young actresses who he's friends with their parents, basically, like Maya Hawke, who is Uma Thurman's and Ethan Hawke's daughter, and Margaret Qualley, who is Andy McDowell's daughter, and
Kevin Smith's daughter.
Oh, right. I can't remember. But anyway, he's got this whole cast of kind of the offspring of people who were either born in the 60s or like growing up in the 60s, and that to me seems like an indication that he acknowledges like that there is a whole new class of kids coming through. And the fact that they're such prominent faces that he's cast to me feels like a very like conscious opening kind of his arms and being like, yeah, I know that I'm not going to be around forever, but there are kind of people who I trust with this, you know, world that we're going into, this brave new world. And maybe that's just me projecting. I don't know. I guess like criticism in some ways is always going to be you projecting. Yeah. But I think, yeah, I really was kind of ready for this to feel like a reactionary, like rallying, raging against the machine. But it doesn't to me. It feels like a fairy tale, which is what it is. But at the same time, it doesn't have any kind of malice behind it. I think it, as I said, as I keep saying, it's a very sweet film, but also very honest, I think, and far less angry than I think a lot of his other films feel.
Right. But Hannah, what scores did you give?
It was a 4 in anticipation, just because I think there was always that worry that this could really be the most poor taste thing possible. And then a 4 in enjoyment, and definitely a 5 in retrospect. I've been through this twice now, and I think it's one I could definitely see myself going back to quite easily. It's really like ranking pretty high at the top of the Tarantino totem pole for me. I think it can't be sort of understated enough if you love cinema, if you love films about films, if you love films about loving films. It really does feel like a kind of a great achievement for him.
Oh, terrific. David, your scores?
I would probably say, I've only seen it once. Mm-hmm. I'd probably say it was 4s across the board.
Right.
I find it very, very enjoyable and lots to sink your teeth into. I think there's some questions that I have about its intentions, and I think maybe there's an argument that it's kind of, I'm trying to sort of avoid spoilers here, that I'm not sure I love what it amounts to.
Yep.
Like, it's a very kind of in the moment enjoyable thing, whereas afterwards I maybe felt a little bit, you know, if it's doing what I think it's doing, then I'm not sure if I see the value in it. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely something I want to revisit, because I think this, you know, as I say, is a book's worth of stuff in there, and you could probably see a different film every time, really. So I'm excited. So maybe a sort of 4-4-5.
I think for me it's a 4-4-3, but I only saw it in Cannes. I think I discussed it with Charles Promesco even on this podcast back then. Or was it, were you on that episode, Hannah? I can't remember. Let's go way back into the May archives and see. 4-4-3, but I think on reviewing it, it might go higher. But listeners, really, you're sport of choice this week. If you want to go for Quentin Tarantino, if you want to go for Christian Petzold, you're laughing either way, I think. But we do have Film Club to get to, which is for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. We are going to revisit Sharon Tate's The Wrecking Crew.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yes, now time for The Wrecking Crew. Sharon Tate had credits in only 5 films in her short career, and this spy spoof was the last one in her lifetime. She appears as Freya Carlson, a ditz from the Danish Tourism Bureau who turns out to be from British Intelligence, alongside Dean Martin as counter-agent Matt Helm, who is tasked with bringing down an evil count who's threatening with the financial stability of the world. Here's the trailer.
$1 billion in American gold en route to London was stolen from a train in Denmark. We can't send in a task force. It's got to be a one-man job.
Let me guess who you got in mind.
Lie down. I want to talk to you.
Oh. I'm a gypsy, Mr. Hill. My father was a gypsy. And he taught us one thing. Wise men enjoy pleasure before business.
I like your father's thinking.
Okay, so Film Club each week is a really great opportunity to revisit old classics, maybe restorations, maybe hidden gems. So, David, where does The Wrecking Crew fit into that?
Well, I think it might be worth re-emphasising this idea of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood being pure fantasy, because there is, as we say, a scene in the film where Sharon Tate goes to see a midday performance of The Wrecking Crew, and they're all laughing really hard at the film. And having seen the film, I'm not sure I buy that in the cold, hard reality. This is the 4th film in the Matt Helm saga after 1966's The Silencers, 1966's The Murderer's Row. Next year's we got The Ambushers. And then we got The Wrecking Crew. And at the end of The Wrecking Crew, we even get a little tee-up for The Ravagers. Matt Helm will be back in The Ravagers, but he wasn't back. No. Maybe Tarantino could imagine what The Ravagers would have been like for his next film. But so Matt Helm is a kind of sexy spy played by Dean Martin. And he sort of slinks around in various colours of turtleneck and is brought in, you know, to save the world. It's a sort of weird knockabout spy caper. I think it's about an hour 45, but it felt like 3 hours. I mean, it's like every scene is like wading through custard. I mean, it's like, it is so slow. You know that kind of Garth Marenghi joke where they say, oh, I take Garth's books and make them thicker. You know, when he sends me the first draft and I just make sure the book looks thicker, whether that's increasing the font size, you know, adding more pages. Mm-hmm. It feels like this has happened to this film. This is a film in like size 72 font. I wish I'd had time to do the due diligence and watch the entire Matt Helm saga I could have actually placed this within the 4 films. But from what I understand, this is by far the worst of the 4. And yeah, Dean Martin, he's introduced, like, I can't even, like, describe his kind of, his introductory scene. I think he moonlights as some kind of fashion photographer. And it's this kind of weird proto-Me Too nightmare where he's, like, lying on a chaise longue in this bit of scrubland, surrounded by scantily clad women who are kind of, seem to be fulfilling his every whim while he photographs them. And, you know, he's ignoring his hotline, which is calling because he's having so much fun. And there is the sort of spoof James Bond element, but also it's very much the films that Mike Myers was spoofing with Austin Powers. It's a charming relic, shall we say.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of it that makes sense now. Phil Coulson, the director, he has this kind of underground reputation as being this guy who was, he was a company man working in the system, just doing the jobs that he was given, flipping between genres, making noirs, westerns, comedies, just whatever came down the chute. And I think that there are these like hardcore auteurist types who are kind of, yeah, Phil Carlson, man. Mm. And so he was making films through the 40s and 50s, and the Matt Helm films were his first significant hit. So it took him 25 years to actually hit kind of financial pay dirt. And then the series quickly went the way of the dodo. Thankfully, I think, maybe.
So I watched this in a pristine HD restoration, and all I say is some films weren't meant to be restored in that way. It makes Dean Martin look ancient. He's only 50 in this film, and his skin is a leather tone. And there's a scene in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood where Brad Pitt, aged 55, takes his top off and the entire cinema swoons
vapors.
At once.
You can hear the vapours.
And I don't
want
to
right
don't think about Dean Martin in this film taking his top off. Don't know what will happen there.
I mean, he looks hungover in every shot to the point where I'm thinking, is that intentional? Like, I mean, it's like he's two scotches in every single take.
There are so many scenes that where he just wanders into a room.
Sorry.
And as you say, it's just thickening out the film. But he's checked out at this point. He only had a few films after this, and then his on-screen career was pretty much over.
And then he came back in the kind of ironic cameos in Cannonball Run. This is the thing that made me laugh, actually. I didn't really laugh at Sharon Tate's pratfalls, which, you know, were a bit uncomfortable. But, like, actually, obviously for added value, that they've got Dean Martin crooning on the soundtrack as well.
Yes.
So, like, he'll enter into a scene and a Dean Martin song will come on and it's like, but his character isn't singing it, and it's kind of not connected to anything that's happening on the screen.
Is he singing now? No, he wasn't.
There's one scene where, we should talk about Sharon Tate's character in this, Freya, who's introduced as this ditz wearing glasses and is this tourism bureau officer. And then as she gets later on in the film, she has a slightly sexy makeover. And one of those scenes where a Dean Martin singing voiceover comes in is where he walks into the scene and she's getting changed just out of shot. And he's like, oh, I can't see your face, but I like your legs. Yeah. It's just, oh, it's leery. That's all. Hell, God. Hannah, what did you make of The Wrecking Crew?
You know, on this podcast, there are a lot of films we watch, and this has to be one of the worst. I mean, it's just, oh, God. It's not my thing anyway, but the way that I watched this film as well was on this, like, Daily Motion Vimeo stream where the image and the sound were wildly out of sync, and that was more entertaining than what was happening in the actual film, just to kind of be like, oh, okay, so, you know, that scene from 10 minutes ago is finally catching up with the what's going on. But yeah, I mean, what can you really say about this film? It's, you know, it's not even like, well, Sharon Tate is really good in it, because she's not, like, no one is good in this film. I wouldn't say it's her fault or Dean Martin's fault or really any of their faults. It's just a very bad film. Mm-hmm. It's the whole premise, I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. So $1 billion of gold was stolen from a train, and it's enough to cause a global financial crisis.
Yeah, this was the 60s.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I mean, sure, why not? You know, it's the kind of thing now, if they made it with, like, Gerard Butler in the lead role, I think people would actually really turn out to see it. Maybe they should do it. Maybe it's right for
Bring
a remake.
Bring back Matt Helm.
I've got to say that there is a retrospective moving element seeing it in the light of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And there's a moment in Once Upon a Time of Hollywood where they juxtapose a sequence where she has a fight with the villain's Asian mistress, who's called, wait for it, Yu Rang. Mm-hmm. Lol. And then they're having a bit of a kind of kung fu dust up in a room. I mean, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood has all these, which I think is quite weird for Tarantino, has all these like comic cutaways that you kind of associate with like almost like Will Ferrell comedies. And one of them is really moving, where you just, it cuts away from this fight to her training with Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is that sense of, like, she's taken this really seriously, and you don't know what a film's going to be like before you are in it, and you can only do the best that you can, really, and be hopeful that it's going to get you your next one, which is also the story of Rick Dalton as well. Yeah. So I think that little shot of her training is superior to the entire film. But I mean,
well, Tarantino has form with maybe making you look differently at yesterday's middle-of-the-road trash. Yeah. Maybe even actors that he's refashioned into new stages of their career, and maybe this can just go alongside those.
Every time a film comes out and he'll go on the press junket tour, it's almost a drinking game of when will Tarantino first reference his love of William Whitney, who is this B-movie westerns director and war movie director who he absolutely adores. And he mentions it every time around. And I think he's on this one man, like, I'm going to make William Whitney the new old tourist poster boy. So, okay. But I think it's interesting that he's picking out these things that would otherwise be completely lost to history. And I think that he did a thing for TV where he picked 10 films that had been influential for Once Upon a Time. And I think that the films he picked for the TV were maybe like, I was hoping that there would be a few more like really naff ones, but the ones he picked were actually like more critically acclaimed films. But a future film festival of films on the marquees in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Oh, the beautiful. Night They Raided Minsky's. I've never seen it, but
it's a good title.
Almost like, I quite want to see that now.
Uh-huh. Well, now, yeah, it's a new Beverly, maybe. Petition him.
We should all go there. Truth and Movies on tour.
Truth and Movies on tour. Yeah, that would be a dream, wouldn't it? If anyone wants to sponsor us to go to Los Angeles and check out.
Quentin wants to invite us out there. I know he listens. So The Wrecking Club, not a great movie.
Wrecking Crew.
What did I say? Wrecking Club.
Wrecking Club.
That's what we are.
I mean, that's the sort of thing that would have got into the script of The Wrecking Crew alongside one of Dean's howling one-liners.
So Wrecking Crew, not a great movie, but a pretty good session band, I will say.
Okay.
That's this week's movies. Up next week, we have Pain and Glory, the latest from Pedro Almodovar, and the documentary Hail Satan? I don't know how to... I'll go all Anchorman.
Hail Satan?
Hail Satan?
In this economy?
And for Film Club, because Pain and Glory is out in cinemas, we're going to look back at Pedro Almodovar's All About My Mother. You can let us know what you think of those films or anything we discussed this week at the usual channels, at Truth and Movies on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email, or the comments section at lblies.com/podcast. David, Hannah, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm Michael Eder. As always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.